tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, this is Ray Barker. You're listening to Full Service Radio. I'm an archivist in the DC Public Library Special Collections. You are listening to All Things Local, where we highlight DC history, culture, and communities and Washingtonians who have made an impact on our city. Today, we are joined by Jay Bruder, Calvin Reibbaum, and Heather Fox. Jay is the only sort of DC regional guy, but we're talking about local music and documenting local music and regional music in Washington, D.C., Akron, Ohio, and Louisville, Kentucky. And we're partially going to share some of the music from those regions with you today and talk to people about how they got into archiving and sharing this music that is, in some instances, not heard in any popular way. And we're promoting an event that's going on tomorrow night at Songbird Cafe and the Record Boutique down the street from Adams Morgan in the Line Hotel here today. So, Jay, we're going to start with you as the DC-ish guy here, the only one who can make that claim. Jay is retired military and from the
Marine Corps.
Marine Corps, thank you, and lives currently now in Alexandria. But I met Jay, six or seven months ago for an oral history for the library and was sort of taken by your collection there, a sizable collection, and this whole history of DC, and not just the music, but you know, you were sharing other ephemera with me about the history here. And again, I come at this from sort of an angle of, I feel like it's not really known, but can you talk a little bit about how this collecting habit interest started?
Yeah, I grew up in a military family and we moved around the world and across the country quite frequently. I came back to the Washington area in the early 1970s and went to high school right about the time that there was this 15-year cycle. In other words, the 50s revival, the first 50s revival was just happening. And I was able to get into that music, and after a while I realized Washington had a great music scene in the 40s and 50s that's really not well documented. So I began just to collect local records, and then I realized that people couldn't really document the club scene. They couldn't document many other aspects. People weren't really collecting the photographs. And of course, back in the 1970s, the institutions didn't really recognize this music as having any worth. It was just another part of popular music, which was pretty well dismissed. So I got into specializing into the Washington area.
Right. And so there's a sort of this a mixed genre history here, and we're going to hear some samples of that pretty soon. But so some of these genres are bluegrass, country,
rhythm and blues.
Rhythm and blues. And so I don't know. Why don't we jump in? I've asked each of the folks here today to curate some samples of their region. And so Jay has graciously shared and brought today, and we'll share some samples from his collection here. We'll play this first track and we'll talk a little bit about it. And then I have a couple of follow-up questions for you, Jay. But so we have an example of an early recording in Washington, D.C., maybe the earliest recording from 1892.
Well, one of the earliest things associated with Washington. You know, when Edison invented the phonograph in 1877, he brought it right to Washington because he thought it was such an important invention, and it was destined for really serious applications such as recording business letters and government correspondence and those type of things. And he was subverted by the people who thought it should be used for the arts. So in 1892, John Philip Sousa's band, an outgrowth of his time in the Marine Corps band, Sousa's band was one of their leading stars, so to speak. And if we could hear the first clip, I'll then tell you what you hear because it's a little faint.
And can we have the title and the artist?
Yeah, this is John Philip Sousa. It's the King Cotton March.
Following that selection, Sousa's latest musical hit, the King Cotton March, was played to the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C.
All All right. I'm going to just give the words again because they are hard to hear the first pass through. The following band selection, Sousa's latest musical hit, The King Cotton March, played for the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C. That's courtesy of David Giovannoni. And if we could hear the clip just one more time so that people can put those words together with what's actually coming over the air.
Following that selection, Sousa's latest musical hit, The King Cotton March, played for the Columbia Phonograph Company of Washington, D.C.
So, should we be aware of Columbia in this narrative here a little bit?
Yes, when Edison set up his regional phonograph, North American Phonograph Company, there was a licensee here in Washington which was called Columbia. And that is still existent through Columbia and CBS. It's all connected. And up until the early 1890s, they worked out of Washington, D.C., and then they moved up to New York City by 1897.
And I wanted to ask, when I went out to your house for that oral history months ago, you'd shared with me the reference work, for lack of a better word, that you were doing. Can you share a little bit more on like how that transpires?
Well, you know, I've had a show on WAMU's Bluegrass Country, and it's now independent as bluegrasscountry.org. And I really play a lot of Washington music on that show, and I was asked to put together a boxed set for Bear Family of Germany, which is turning out to be 16 CDs, 475 tracks, and liner notes with about 140 artist biographies. And so mastering is done. Liner notes are still in progress.
Right, and then that's going to drop sometime in the fall or before Christmas, or is that later?
I have a feeling now it's going to be next year.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, let's keep listening to some tracks here, and then we'll move on to Calvin and the Akron Sound Museum.
So I'll just lead you on, because right after that Columbia departure in 1897, nothing much happened, and the recording industry in Washington shriveled during the teens. But in the 1920s, we had a very, very popular radio preacher here in town named Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mashaw, and the RCA Victor Company recorded him over the telephone wires up in Camden. And this was an actual radio broadcast here in Washington on WJSV from December of 1933. Second track, please. Okay, so that's Elder Lightfoot Solomon Mashaw. He was on WJSV, which was 1460 AM. Sometime in the 1940s, there was a big house cleaning in the radio frequencies. It became 1500, and shortly after that, it became WTOP. And I very, very well remember in the mid-1960s, driving around early on Sunday morning, you could hear the Elder Mashaw and his congregation on AM radio here in Washington, some 30 years after he started.
And do you feel like that those in particular are well documented in terms of the that picture and time?
Actually, his church has kept extraordinarily good audio and paper records. And Suzanne Smith of George Mason is working with the Mashaw family to publish a biography.
Cool. Yeah, I just want to remind anyone who's listening, this is Ray Barker in the Archivist and Special Collections Department at the Public Library. We're in the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan talking to Jay Bruder today about early D.C. music, and then Calvin Reibaum will be talking about the Akron Sound, and Heather Fox from Louisville will be speaking about the Louisville music scene, and this is all part of a panel that we're doing tomorrow night at Songbird Cafe down the street. But we're going to wrap up Jay's segment here and with listening to a couple more tracks, and the next one's about what was going on in World War II.
You know, the wartime brought thousands and thousands of people into Washington, and one of the people that came up to Washington to work in the Navy Yard was a man named Arthur Smith, country musician from Charlotte, North Carolina, and he recorded a record for the Feld Brothers, who ran the Super Disc label here, and they had Super Drugs and Super Music. And so, if I may, track three. I think a lot of people will recognize this track, even if they don't know what it was called. So that's the original Guitar Boogie, which was redone many, many times. I say it's the song that launched a million guitar lessons, because anybody who's been to a guitar lesson has had to learn that at one point.
First thing I ever learned on the guitar. But I love, I hear a little blues in there, a little bit of country and a little bit of rock and roll, all in that little riff.
Yep.
But it's from 1945. Jay, I was just going to say, I feel like you could have your own podcast here, and we can just leave the studio and let you go through your library.
Well, that's kind of what I've done on the radio previously, so we're just going to scope it down here.
So, right, we've got two more to go here. So Mrs. Lillian Claiborne was huge in D.C. and quite a character, but I would want to know a little bit more about her activities with D.C. Records, and we're in what time frame here for this?
Mrs. Claiborne came back to Washington, D.C. from her long sojourn in New York City in the late 1940s. 1947, she launched a record label. She recorded pop, society bands, country bands, and the vocal groups, especially in 1948 during the musician strike. She loved to record the vocal groups because they didn't go against the union. It was very straightforward.
I have to interrupt you, though. So if a woman in a man's world, right? I mean, that had to be pretty rare.
She did have a male partner early on, and then she struck out on her own, but her personality was such that she was able to hold her own.
And she stayed in D.C., or did she head out to New York?
No, she stayed in Washington through her passing in 1974.
But can we talk a little bit more? What was her role then? A businesswoman or a record producer or an A&R person or what?
She was everything. This was a self-contained label. She wrote the songs. She found the talent. Harold Lucas of the Clovers told me he remembered seeing her down at the Howard Theater trying to round up talent around 1950. So she got all over town, and she's a white woman. She recorded black artists, she recorded country artists, she recorded pop and society artists.
And so DC Records, and so where was that located? Where were the offices?
930 F Street.
Really?
Which is kind of an iconic address.
The 930 Club.
The original address for the 930 Club, but they were after she had left the building.
Huh, that's great.
So
go ahead.
We have one clip from her R&B period. A man named Frank Motley, who was known for playing two trumpets at one time, which is quite the trick, and a group that she thought was going to crack the national chart called the Heartbreakers. Track five, please.
Shot, rubbing and stomping, you never stop. Moving and wiggling, but never stop. Playing too hard, Molly gets hot. You never heard such blending since you were born. When he starts to sending, Gable throws away his horn. Rock, rock, don't let him stop. Swinging and blowing on boppy bop. Swinging and blowing is what you got. Playing too hard, Molly gets hot.
Ray, that was one of the unreleased sides that Mrs. Claiborne left in her vaults, and thanks to Les Moss at Roadhouse Records, he put it out during the Collector revival in the early 1970s.
And Jay, you were writing those liner notes that you mentioned earlier for that huge box set, and Mrs. Claiborne gets her due at...
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
She was an outsized influence on the Washington market.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. So we're coming into landing now with bluegrass, and I'm hoping Heather can pick up this thread, maybe not, you know.
Well, you know, Washington had, as I showed earlier, quite the commercial, the country community because of not only the in-migration, but there was a country community here in Washington for a long time. And in the late 40s, there began to be a divergence between traditional country and commercial country. And the bluegrass guys, although they didn't even call it bluegrass until the later 1950s, early 1960s, they stayed on the acoustic side. They kind of resisted the electrical side of country music. One of the best-known groups out of Washington, the Country Gentlemen, and this is their first recording. This is track 7. It's called Going to the Races, and very traditional bluegrass sound.
Some fast playing there. But I was hoping to that tomorrow night's panel, one of the things I hope that comes out of that is a discussion about the impact beyond the boundaries of wherever these artists lived and played. And so do we have a sense, for example, and we can wrap up the Jay Bruder show portion here with this. Do you have a sense of, for Country Gentlemen, Dixie, if those guys ever had much of an impact outside of this region?
Yeah, they had a huge impact, and they actually enjoyed a national hit a few years later. So they were very successful, and that's several shows in itself, just tracing their career.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Jay. And I don't mean for any of the other panelists to be sitting silently while we have a conversation, but hopefully we'll have some time for more of a dialogue, a group dialogue, than just this one-on-one stuff we've been doing. But now, so we're moving over now to Calvin Reibam, who just arrived from Akron, Ohio. So I was hoping he would come in mid-episode.
In the nick of time.
Yeah, I just made it with 10 pounds of vinyl records under his arm. Not really, but so he'd sent the digital files.
On his back.
before today. But so, Calvin, kind of going down a similar path that we went down with Jay, can you talk a little bit about the Akron sound and what that means? I mean, so I can throw out my theory and tell me I'm wrong. But so that's the other one of these other themes of the panel is this thing about, well, what is regional about regional music? And so Akron, Ohio, where I happen to be from, is Midwestern. And what does that mean? Well, it means you can work a job, some 9-to-5 job, whatever you want to call it, not a blue collar job, but, you know, just a job, and have enough time because the cost of living is lower to do these things. And, you know, the other aspect is there's plenty of room. And that means there's room to practice and blah, blah, blah. And you can go down that checklist there. But so, like, if we think of bands like Devo, or if we think of what the Akron sound is any of that in place? Or can we talk about that a little bit, about what is the Akron sound?
Yeah, we can. I have a quick question for Jay, though. What was the year of the Sousa recording?
We think 1892, because the Cotton Convention in Atlanta was held that year, and that was the year the song was composed, and they said it was his latest musical hit.
So to tie in D.C. with Akron, I could make a connection that Akron perhaps had one of the first Edison recording equipment in it, because
yes,
as you probably know, he married in 1886 a woman from Akron, was in Akron quite a bit during that period, and the wedding in 1886 was a social event of the decade in Akron.
I'm going to commend you for sitting on that for so long and just revealing that now. That's great.
Thomas Edison also lived in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, well, okay.
He got around
Edison
very well.
Themed.
Who knew?
But so this thing about the Midwestern sound, I mean, how is that? What is that?
Well, first off, I don't believe there's actually a Akron sound in the way there are other regional sounds that they were similar. There was a bunch of very creative people at around the same time who really all knew each other and work together. They all seem to work at two or three different record stores in Akron at the same time.
And what is that time period we're talking about?
Early 70s. There's two things going on. There is Kent State, which in some ways is overstated.
The shootings in 71?
Mm-hmm. So that was overstated a bit. There's a few people that have liked to written articles saying this caused the Akron Sound. This caused the anger.
Mm-hmm.
Recently this year, a Washington Post article made that argument. And members of two of the bands that were specifically mentioned in there told me, like, that's nonsense. We never even mentioned Kent State when we started our bands.
And that one of those was Devo?
No. It was Tin Huey and the Bizarros. Although I would say a later member of Tin Huey, who had a lot to do with their success, Chris Butler, was strongly affected by Kent State and has done some later projects in himself about Kent State. So it did affect it somewhat. You know, Mark Mothersbaugh had a studio and he was right on campus when that happened. Chrissy Hynde was right on campus when it happened. So yes, that happened. Also the Midwest thing. You talk to these people and they will all say it was dark, it was dirty, you couldn't own a white car, and we didn't want to follow our parents into the rubber plants. And that's why we started bands. So yeah, there was a very much getting out of the working class Midwest thing with maybe a blanket of Kent State thrown over it.
Nice. Okay, yeah, and Kent's right next door to Akron, so that makes sense. But I was going to ask you a quick question, and we can get to the first tracks. Calvin has brought three tracks with him. But I wanted to ask about, and I just drew a blank on it. Darn it, I just drew a blank on what my question was.
I don't know, just circle back around. Maybe you'll remember it.
Sure. Let's go from let's go from there. I know what it was. Yeah, the London that's never happened before. But I know that there were stories about like Akronite in some of these London clubs or these clubs in England. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because one of the questions, of course, is are there any implications beyond Akron and everyone who's living in Akron or living in DC? They're huge. Everybody knows these guys, and sometimes it's just not true. But can you tell me a little bit of that theme night?
I have found hard evidence that there were Akronites in London clubs. That was a bit of an accident, really. Devo was on tour in England very earlier in their career, Mark was giving an interview to a music magazine in England, and the writer, looking for an angle, asked, "What's Akron like?" Mark, thinking, well, it's dark and dirty and working class, said Akron's a lot like Liverpool. The writer went back and wrote an article about how Akron is the new Liverpool. And it just sort of happened.
And who are Akron's Beatles? I don't know if we ever decided that.
Actually, I have a letter from Bump Magazine that also was a label, writing Chris in Akron saying that I know for sure Devo's going to be the new Beatles.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
I love that.
They could be my Beatles.
So we'll play a first track, and then we'll come back and talk about the Akron Sound Museum, which I actually was fortunate enough to visit a couple of weekends ago. So tell us a little bit about this first track. Do you know what the first track is?
Not until you tell me.
Well, what was one of the ones that you selected? What you can pick.
How about the Bizarros?
And can you just introduce that track a little bit? Anything you want to say about the Bizarros?
Well, the Bizarros played a large part in the Akron Sound, not just as musicians, but Nick Nicholas, their lead singer and lyric writer, mostly early on, started up his own label after talking to Stiv Bators about how it would be a good idea. And Clone Records had 16 releases from about 77 to 81. And a lot of the Akron Sound documented was because of what Nick did. He released From Akron with a split of him and the Rubber City Rebels. And the Bizarros actually are still recording. They put out a new album just a few weeks ago.
And this track is from 79 or?
No, it's a little, it is 79. This is their one major record release on Mercury.
Okay.
And what's the song title on that one?
It should be under like Girls Market.
Don't think I have that one. I have Jimmy Bell here, Slide Tin Huey, and Rubber City Rebels. Those are the three that I have here.
Well, then, I didn't send them that
one. Oh, okay. Well, we can move on to
another. Let's go with Jimmy Bell, then.
So my understanding is that was the Numbers Band and playing, right, Calvin?
Right.
Right. And can you give us a little bit of insight on those guys? I know they're still out and still playing, and I've seen them play once.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a Pretenders connection there, too, with right?
Well, Terry Hine, their saxophone player since 69, is Chrissy's brother. Bob and Jack Kidney are the other longstanding members. And yes, they are still playing, and they're about to have a show for Bob's 80th birthday, but Jimmy Bell back in town. That's, I believe, a live cut while opening for Bob Marley and the Wailers in the 70s. It's also a very significant Akron Sound tune because Chris Butler actually sent that when Chris was in that band trying to promote the Akron Kent scene to Robert Christgau of the Village Voice, and was the impetus to him visiting Akron and writing the article about the Akron Sound, and kind of launched the idea of there was an Akron Sound. But, you know, the Numbers Band have been a huge part of Northeast Ohio music for decades. Robert has left a couple times to, he was with Dave Thomas's band from Pere Ubu for a couple of years, and he also is on a couple Golden Palominos albums.
Okay, and I, as I said earlier, before the we broke for the track, I'd been to visit the Akron Sound Museum just on the border of the Akron University of Akron campus, next to the bomb shelter. This kind of goofy, not goofy in a good way, this interesting vintage shop. But can you talk a little bit about that physical space and some of the physical donations and collections that you have there? And then I'm going to follow it up with a question about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame down the road.
Well, the physical space itself is, yes, it's a resale shop, but it's very set up nostalgia. It's so much more than just a regular resale shop. But there are also a couple other places in it. There's a television museum in there. There's us. And then there is a store that just sells vintage audio equipment. Hmm. So it's a good match for us.
And then how did you start collecting?
Well, I mean, I was at, you know, the bank in JB's when it was going on.
And those are venues in Akron.
Right. There's really kind of three ground zeros, the Crypt, the Bank, and JB's. And JB's was in Kent. The other two were in Akron. And that's where all the people in this scene essentially played during that point. So I was in two of those places. And so I knew about them. I mean, I do freelance archiving. I actually have a number of clients at different time. When the Akron Sound Museum approached me a couple years ago, well, I already had, you know, the Tin Huey LP, the Rubber City Rebels RP that came out on Capitol a few years later, the Bizarros one. So I had a lot of the music. So I was able to capitalize in the years I spent going to bars listening to bands towards this project.
Great. And can you talk a little bit about your relationship to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Because we're talking about regional music here, and what, you know, what regional Akron bands. I mean, we think of Devo, of course, first. And so there's got to be this overlap with this sort of international popularity for a while there with Devo in particular versus this local, you know, this sort of other nature of local bands. So what does that overlap look like with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is like 45 minutes north of Akron?
Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame actually has a really nice initiative of collecting local music. All of Northeast Ohio, maybe even farther into Toledo, Youngstown. But our relationship with them is very good. I've been up there to talk with them a few times. They've made the offer that if I ever needed help with storage or some things, that they would help me out. They asked for a copy of my book on the Akron Sound. I know sometimes in at least Northeast Ohio, there's a sense that perhaps our little museum is in conflict with them, but it's not that way at all.
Well, it's weird. I invited them to our panel tomorrow night and they refused. I'm just kidding. But but then can we move on to one track and wrap up your segment, Calvin? So I think we have a Rubber City Rebels track.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something we can jump into? Do you want to introduce that a little bit?
The Rebels are a very interesting story because they were arguably the most popular cover band in town under the name of King Cobra. And another huge lucky break in the Akron Sound. One of the bars they were playing was called The Crypt, which was actually a rubber workers bar across the street from Goodyear. And it was always packed during the day with rubber workers, but not usually so much at night. So the guy who owned it would bring in bands. And there was a big rubber strike, and I guess his wife wanted him home more because he had a full-time job at Goodyear. And one day he just pitched to the Rebels. It's like, hey, you guys are the only band that really makes money here. How would you guys like to just run the bar? And if you pay the mortgage, I'm good with it. So this guy turned his bar over to a couple rockers in their early 20s who immediately called their friends Stiv and Mark because the lead singer of the Rebels lived in the same apartment building with Mark Mothersbaugh, and he had been King Cobra's sound man, put together a somewhat legendary New Year's Eve show in Akron where the three bands played. And that was also the night that Stiv told the Rebels, hey, that song Rubber City Rebels you guys have, that's a great theme song. You had to change your name to that instead of being King Cobra. And then the Rebels went out to L.A. and played the Whiskey a Go-Go a lot. And the guy from the Knack produced some stuff for them. And they put out some stuff on RCA. And they still do stuff. I mean, their biggest hit a couple years ago was on probably the Tony Hawk video game. They've been one of those bands that has not quite broken through for God knows how many decades.
All right, let's move in. Let's play that track then. So that was the Rubber City Rebels from Akron, Ohio in the late 70s. Just a reminder, we're speaking to Jay Bruder, Calvin Reitbaum, and Heather Fox, and they are in town for an event at Songbird tomorrow night, Wednesday night, down the street, talking about regional music from Akron, Ohio, Louisville, Kentucky, and Washington, D.C., the early days of recorded music here in D.C. But I was just going to wrap up Calvin Reitbaum's portion here with Akron, and I just want to name drop a few more bands. Well,
Child Eaters, Buzz Click, who's their lead guitarist, has told me a couple times that they wrote that song to prove they could write a really stupid punk song.
Mm-hmm.
They had been a very successful band going out covering Bad Company and Kiss for a couple years. Their drummer and bassist did not want to make the switch to punk. So they said, well, we're going to write one of these songs to prove it, how easy it is. Buzz told me that they only used two chords in the song because they couldn't figure out how to write a song with one.
Okay.
But this song, Child Eaters, is stupid and weird on purpose.
Keep it stupid, simple. No, but we didn't get to mention the Black Keys, of course, and my understanding is those guys are no longer in Akron. But I know one of them moved to Nashville. But the other one I wanted to talk about were the waitresses, then we can move on to Heather.
Well, actually, I did see Pat a few weeks ago at a memorial for his uncle Ralph, who unfortunately passed away in an accident in December. And Ralph was the saxophone player for Tin Huey, and then years with Tom Waits and a couple years with the B-52s.
Right, so really active in that, in those particular scenes.
And just to mention, Tracy Thomas of Unit 5, her nephew is in Red Sun Rising, which is a very popular group now. So there's sort of another generation coming that are descendants of that era.
Mm. Cool. So let's end on that. Great. Thanks, Calvin. So Heather, thanks again for being here.
Thank you
and
for having me.
So Heather's in town for this archives conference as well. But the Louisville Sound. So I was just going to talk a little bit about my familiarity with it. And it's
okay.
Back to the mid 90s with a band I love, a chamber rock kind of classical influenced
hybrid
rock music, yeah. Not classic rock. Rachel's, who I love. And Will Oldham, of course, the Palace stuff.
Yeah.
But we were talking earlier about, so that's the mid 90s. And so some of the things that I feel are interesting is that not only are some of those artists still going,
yeah,
but we were talking about these new bands and these new artists and how it's more vital than ever. And then you yourself play in a band. So why don't we talk about the vitality of what the scene now?
Right. I was actually going to say that's a nice segue from Calvin to me, because my argument in my presentation is that it's a continuum. And the scene is thriving. Do you want me to go back to the first punk band in Louisville was called No Fun. That's widely agreed upon as the first punk band.
And this is 1978.
Mm-hmm. I will be actually playing some video, kind of a little mini docs in my presentation tomorrow. So you'll actually get to hear from
Songbird 6:30. So
yeah,
please come.
I have some little Instagram mini docs embedded there. So people will see, yeah, it's going to be awesome. Anyway, yeah, so 1978 is the first punk band. You know, the 80s were strong. The 90s, as you know, were super hot.
And I need to interrupt you, though. Can we mention what you do during the day in Luma a little bit? I'm sorry, that was
That's
my
okay.
fault. Louisville Underground Music Archive. And can you talk a little...
Guide me, interviewer.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your
yes.
9-to-5 job, your full-time
my
job.
My 9-to-5 job is at the University of Louisville Archives and Special Collections. I'm the director of the Oral History Center there, and I'm also the archivist for local community manuscript collections.
Nice. Okay.
In 2013... actually, in about 6 months, 2012 to 2013, we had three sort of heavy hitters in the scene pass away in a short period of time.
And who were they?
John Camp Schaefer, John Cook, and Jason Noble. So the one you've heard of is Jason Noble. He was in Rachel's.
Oh, well.
And Rodan.
That's
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
so their passing led to...
Correct, yes. I had just started working at the U of L in 2013, and so it's a long story that I'll tell more of tomorrow, but we said we better start collecting this stuff now because our friends are dying, and, you know, this is an important part of Louisville's cultural history. Let's start collecting. Since I've been in the scene for 25 years, you know, I mean, I know a lot of the people, so probably not unlike Calvin. Just sort of reached out to John's sister and said, you know, we're starting this project. We want to preserve his legacy. And so that's how it started.
Right.
The Louisville Underground Music Archive
okay.
project.
Great.
Yes.
If I could jump in.
Jump in.
And that's Jay.
Hi, Jay.
The same thing has happened in Washington, and I'm sure it happens in every major urban area, that things tend to disappear before academic institutions realize they're important.
Right on.
And tremendous amount has been lost from Washington. It's very, very difficult to find an air check of any of the African-American disc jockeys from Washington in the 1950s. Let me just say, I don't know of any that are extant.
Right.
So kudos right. to your institution for taking the initiative to capture what they can when they can.
Right, thank you. And I want to give a shout out to our director, Carrie Daniels. She is, Carrie Daniels, myself, and Elizabeth Riley are the three people that work on this project. She's our director, and she used to go to shows in Boston when she lived there. So she immediately understood the importance and the impact that the local music scenes have on not just the young people, all the people.
Right. That's great. And I interrupted your narrative when we were talking about those early bands of Rachel's and the passing of those. But if wherever you want to go from here.
Actually, Ray, could I
jump in?
Ask a quick question.
Right on.
To Jay's point, though, I think a lot of people see what you're collecting as important and cultural.
Today.
And I was wondering how Luma deals with a feeling among a lot of people that somehow collecting punk goes against the idea of punk. I mean, you probably know the reaction the British Museum got a year or two ago when they tried to do a punk collection.
We have had mixed reactions from this project. Some people, I can think of, you know, every scene has local collectors. There are some local collectors that say they will never donate their material to us, and, you know, your institution can go to hell. There are a lot of people that say thank you. I've had people hand me, you know, the last set list that his friend ever wrote because his friend died 2 years ago, and, like, crying, handing me the set list saying, if I leave this in my basement, it's going to get destroyed. But if I give it to you, I know where it's going to be and I know how to find it. And so we've had, you know, it's been the spectrum of reactions.
I was going to give a shout out to Michelle Casto here at DCPL and Special Collections and
yeah.
who you know. And I have to say that a comment on her efforts and collecting on the punk scene here in DC.
Right. So. That's how I met Michelle. She came down when we were starting Luma and talked about the DC Punk Archive.
We're all over the place here, but I have to ask about this photo show that I read about online there. Can we talk about that?
Yes. Yes, it's called From a Dark Room. It just opened on July 13th. It's an exhibit documenting the Louisville scene. There are almost 300 photographs in the exhibit, and the first photo is from 1978, and the most recent one is from a couple of months ago. So, and it is not organized in any kind of way. Everything's just thrown up there. So all the, you know, the historic photos and the contemporary photos are commingled.
Yeah, and I like that what I saw online was the people from the photographs were there to see you know, earlier versions of themselves.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yes, there's so, one of, yeah.
And so why don't we play one of the tracks that you've brought? Again, I know we're all over the place, and we're kind of
going to
wrap up here in a few minutes.
Let's play Girlwood, because that is the most recent and...
And can we talk, so a current band, very active band, and it's two women?
Yeah, it is called Girlwood, G-R-L-W-O-O-D. They are self-described as a two-piece band of Kentucky Fried Queerdos. How about that? And they do scream pop. That's what they call it. Their names are Karen Ledford and Ray Foster. And I hope you enjoy it. They're on fire. They play all the time, everywhere. They're even touring already.
Great. Heather, who was that again?
That band is called Girlwood. That is Ray Foster and Karen Ledford.
Yes. Why don't we close with just a little bit about your band and you're playing... why don't we talk about your band and we can end on that.
Okay, my band is called Juanita. Our first show was the New Year's Eve between 1992 and 1993. We are self-taught. You know, it was the time when, oh, let's just start a band. Nobody knew how to play their instruments, so we just started a band. It originally was an all-woman band, and now we are a primarily lady band. We've been playing for 25 years, took a brief hiatus when I had a child, and people describe us as a garage rock collective.
Cool, and I'm a big Will Oldham fan, and I guess he's still around walking the streets of Louisville, is that?
Yes, I was with him 2 days ago. He came to our band practice. We're playing on Saturday at Bernheim Forest, if you're in Kentucky, and Will often sits in with us and sings a few tunes.
Well, great. So I'm going to kind of wrap things up just as sort of a teaser for tomorrow night's panel, talking about these things in more detail and sharing more music after the panel. We're doing an hour and a half or something of music from all of these different regions, and there's a soul, go-go, and R&B element that Kevin Coombe will be filling in post Jay Bruder, just a DC thing. But thanks everyone for being here
today.
And I'm going to read my outro here. This has been an episode of All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library services and programs. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter at DCPL Library. At DC Public Library on Instagram. Listen and download the show wherever you listen to your podcasts by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you, everyone, and have a great day.